Way back in 2008, Clay Christensen, Michael Horn, and Curtis Johnson published Disrupting Class: How Disrupting Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns. In it, they predicted that online learning was going to be a disruptive innovation for America's schools. Now, it seems like an eternity later, we check in with Michael Horn to find out whether those predictions have come true and what digital learning means for the bigger issues in education policy. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for joining us over Skype, speaking of a disruptive innovation. Let's start with some background. The book first came out in 2008. I'm curious, how has it been received and how is it selling? Most education books don't sell well. How about this one?
I think it sold pretty well for an education book. You know, it's a good question, and I think part of it was that it appealed to a wide audience, both a lot of the traditionalists who were feeling the pressure to change what they were doing and respond to some of the trends in education, but also a lot of the people in the reform communities and some of the even further reform communities, such as the online learning innovators, who were really seeking to transform the system in some pretty radical ways. I think it had some wide appeal, which helped it get some good reception from the outset. Of course, a lot of people thought we were crazy with some of our predictions in 2008 as well, but I'm sure we can talk about that as we dive in.
Absolutely. And in terms of reactions, I mean, have you had anybody push back hard against the ideas in the book?
You know, the biggest pushbacks, I think, were from two groups. One, people who we use the notion of the theory of multiple intelligences and learning styles just to be illustrative of the fact that people have different learning needs at different times. And I think a lot of the people very steeped in cognitive and neuroscience research quickly jumped on that and said, you guys don't really understand this. And they have a point, I think. We're certainly not cognitive or neuroscientists. And I tend to think that it really is illustrative of the fact that we learn at different paces. People have different working memory capacities. They have different aptitudes for different topics, and everyone brings in different learning knowledge as they enter a topic. So it doesn't really change the point of the book, but that was definitely one area where we got pushback. The second one, surprisingly, was from the traditional edtech community itself. And I think that's, you know, when we came out with the book, we sort of said, hey, guys, this is why education technology hasn't had much impact to this point, and here's how it could have a big impact if you implemented it in this way. And what's interesting, I think, is I thought we were doing them a favor. They didn't like the fact that we said you've basically wasted a lot of money and not had much impact. And a lot of the traditional ed tech community, as a result, I think, wasn't pleased with that part of the book.
Oh, that's interesting. I have wondered that. All the excitement right now about digital learning, it's almost a new brand name for it. But of course, education technology, people have been around a long time and have been promoting some of these ideas as well. Okay, good. We'll talk about that, including the multiple intelligences, which I plan to push on you as well.
Great.
Tell us a little backstory. So you got to write a book with Clay Christensen, who is one of the world's experts on innovation. How did that happen?
Total dumb luck, if we're being honest. I had worked for David Gergen in public policy and writing, and been sick of both things, to be totally honest, and went to business school trying to get away from it. And while I was there, I took Clay Christensen's class, and it totally changed the way I saw the world. And then literally at the end of class one day, he said, look, guys, I want to write this book on public education. Anyone interested in co-authoring with me, come on and stop by afterwards. Wow. And so I stopped by. One thing led to another. I think he thought about it for about 3 months before signing me up. And then we jumped on board and took it to where it was. It was a two-year process after that.
All right. Very interesting. Well, it's very exciting. And launched you on a whole new career focused on disruptive innovation in the social sector, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes to show that life throws you curveballs. Just run with them.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about multiple intelligences. You do start off the book by trying to make the case for a more customized education by saying that kids learn differently, and therefore the standardized approach to education that we've had in place for 100 years just doesn't work, as you say, Dan Willingham and other cognitive scientists said, hey, hold on. The research on this stuff's not that good. The differences are often exaggerated. In reality, differences aren't that great. So you're now saying what? That this is not an essential part of your argument?
What we're saying is that there's tremendous fights still going on in the academic community around these areas. I think that the weight of the evidence tends to support Willingham's points, as I read it at the moment. But I don't think it undermines the need for customization in the way we teach and presenting customized opportunities for students. Because what Willingham and others will quickly say is, it's certainly the case that people learn at different paces. It's certainly the case that you want to target learning to just above someone's skill development and ability so that it's not something too easy that they just turn off to the task, or something too hard that they'll never attain it. And that people have profoundly different working memory capacities. They chunk information in different ways. And everyone enters a learning experience with different backgrounds of knowledge. So if you come into a learning experience and I start talking about it with a vocabulary that you don't yet understand, or with experiences you haven't been exposed to, you're going to start focusing on those things you don't understand and miss the actual purpose of the lesson. And all of that, I think, still suggests the need for that customization. So my argument more is I take the fifth on where these things will go. My gut is that there are more differences, that the learning software itself actually will figure out in the future far more in a far more fine-grained way than any academics sitting at Harvard will. But it doesn't really matter, because there are these clear differences of how we learn, and suggesting the need for customization.
And when you talk about software, you imagine learning software that's going to be adaptive. Kids get this question right and this question wrong, and it starts to figure out what they know, what they don't know.
That's exactly right. And I suspect it's actually a much harder problem, I think, to solve than people realize, because everyone loves to throw up the Netflix and Amazon analogies of how they know the book you want or the movie you want before you know it. And we do too as well in the book. But given all of those things about background knowledge, students like you may not be like you when you come up to another topic. It's an immense, how do you assess it accurately and to glean these things? It's an immensely more complicated problem. And the sheer numbers of students you need on an adaptive learning platform, I think, to be able to get the accurate data to start to make those sorts of predictions, I think we're still several years away from that.
Okay. All right. Now, let's get to the basics here for folks that are not familiar with Clay Christensen's ideas. Just very simple. What is disruptive innovation?
Sure. Disruptive innovation, horrible name, right, by the way, because it implies a lot of things in the English language. But what he meant by it is an innovation that comes along and transforms a market where the products or services are complicated, expensive, inaccessible, and deeply centralized, and therefore can only serve a limited few people, into one that's characterized by products and services that are far more affordable, convenient, accessible, and decentralized. So the classic story that we often tell is of the disruption of the personal, or of the mainframe and mini computers by the personal computer, which allowed many, many more people to have affordable computing. And of course, smartphones and tablets are now disrupting the personal computer in some pretty profound ways. We've seen it in the automotive industry. We've seen the U.S. Postal Service be disrupted by email. You can point to lots of sectors in both the for-profit, not-for-profit, highly regulated and unregulated, where you've seen this phenomenon play out.
All right. And then as you lead up into how this is going to impact schools, you talk about disruptive performance measures. I think that was your phrase. This idea that over time schools have been given new jobs to do within this old structure. What are you talking about here?
Yes. I'm glad you actually quoted it accurately, because I had forgotten that. What's interesting, I think, is that if you look at society's jobs that it's assigned school to essentially do, it's changed over time. Initially, the common school and schooling was really designed to inculcate democratic values in its students. Just a little bit of learning so that you could have an intelligent conversation and do some reading, but it was really about preserving the democracy. And then it switched in the early 1900s, late 1800s, with the fast rising industrial Germany. People were really worried with the Industrial Revolution that the U.S. would fall behind. And so the purpose of schooling really became to just put tons of students through the school system, batch process them, give them enough education that they could find the job that made sense for them, and really offer lots of vocational tracks and so forth for different aptitudes for students. Some students would absolutely go on to higher education and learn to be the leaders of the society. Others, not so much. They would just get enough skills so that they could go into the factory floor. And then in the late 70s and 80s, we switched it again when we really moved into saying, you know, wait a second, look at this rise of Japan. They're graduating however many more times scientists and mathematicians and engineers than we are, despite having a much smaller population. It turns out we haven't been teaching our students much, and we have to have everyone excel in some pretty clear ways. And so average test score became the metric of performance. And then I think the fourth one we point to, which is debatable, I think, is that No Child Left Behind signaled it was no longer the average test score we were concerned with. We were actually concerned with really eradicating poverty in some sense and making sure we lifted every single child over a minimum bar at the low end so that we could say every child was proficient in some basic skills to get along in society to match the need for this knowledge economy worker that we now have.
And it seems to me that you give the public schools some credit in the book for adjusting to all of these different goals put before them. But the goal line keeps moving and they do a decent job of changing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it's one of the reasons that the book was reasonably well received, perhaps by some people who maybe haven't liked books of this ilk in the past. The and I think if you look at it, it's true that the schooling system has done a better job than many businesses at adapting to fundamentally different value propositions throughout its history. The schooling system obviously started with the inculcate democracy. And so as a mission, it did a reasonable job on that. It did spectacularly well, I think, on that second job of batching lots of students together, funneling them through the system, and then spitting them out on the other end and sort of sorting them, if you will, into the careers that made sense for them. And the reason I think it was able to do so well on that, actually, is because high school, the comprehensive high school, didn't really exist before this job sprung up. And so in many ways, the school system was able to innovate from scratch and then did a remarkable job of just adding lots and lots of courses and shopping mall type array of services in the comprehensive school over 70, 80 years.
You could almost call that comprehensive high school like a platform.
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And they did a good job of just sustaining innovations on that platform. The trick then became on that third job when we started saying, hey, boost average test scores, and particularly with No Child Left Behind. And there was a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of fighting over whether this was the true purpose of schooling and so forth. But given the install base over which they worked, I think you'd have to say that the modest improvements in NAEP scores and the like have been significant given the install base and the fixed business model that the schooling system has had. I don't think you'd say that it was a slam dunk that they nailed it on those jobs by any means, but just that it's worth giving them credit for having done better than you might expect when you've just radically changed the job that you've asked an established business model to do. In any other industry, we've never seen a business model pivot so dramatically, and schools have done a relatively better job along those dimensions. Of course, in other industries, we have disruptive innovations come along and wholesale replace those industries, or excuse me, those existing businesses, and we haven't had that luxury or ability to do that with the school system.
Right. So let's talk about the schools in terms of now the disruptive innovation there. You talk, of course, a lot about technology, but you start by saying that schools to date haven't done a very good job incorporating technology.
Yeah, that's right. We see that technology in schooling has been around for, well, now it's 2.5 decades, when the book came out, a couple decades, where we've been spending wildly on computers in schools to equip them in the back of classrooms and computer labs and so forth. and they really hadn't moved the needle at all. We spent, we threw out the figure in the book, $60 billion over two decades, spending money on computers in schools. I think that's actually a conservative estimate. I think if you looked at all the software purchases and so forth, it'd be actually much higher than that. But we wanted to give, you know, be conservative on that one. And it hasn't really moved the needle at all in terms of achievement. You see a couple great implementations here or there, but it really hasn't done much at all. And our hypothesis was, as we agreed a lot with Larry Cuban actually on this point, who's been a critic of cramming computers into the classroom, was that schools actually in this regard looked a lot like all of the other things we had studied from lots of other industries with disruptive innovation. That is, when an existing business sees a potentially disruptive innovation, their instinct is to cram it into their current operating model to sustain what they already do, but not fundamentally transform or offer a new value proposition around it. And if you looked at it, cramming computers into the typical classroom structure is classic of that behavior. It doesn't actually transform the role of teachers or students or the arrangement of learning. It just tries to add a little bit more on the side, if you will.
So then how can we disruptively deploy computers?
Exactly the chapter's name, if I recall. So the key is, whenever you see a disruptive innovation, it starts in these areas of non-consumption, where the alternative is literally nothing at all, because for some reason the consumer can't afford or access or use the existing service or technology. And the trick with applying this theory to public education in the United States was, it's not at all clear where those areas of non-consumption would be, because schooling is largely compulsory. But if you look at it from the perspective of disrupting the classroom as we've known it, there's actually lots of areas of non-consumption, particularly in high school. So credit recovery, dropout recovery are huge areas of non-consumption. We have 30% of students leaving the school system, lots of students in urban districts that fail courses and have no meaningful way to regain those credits. And being able to offer online learning in different models, whether it's in brick and mortar shopping malls or virtually or whatnot, is a really unique and promising way to launch the disruptive innovation to get those students back on track. Advanced courses are another huge area of non-consumption. We know that 40% or so of schools do not offer AP courses, but the story is actually much bleaker. As of 2007, 26% of high school students in America attended a school that did not offer an advanced course, defined as anything above geometry, so no algebra 2, no calculus, defined as anything above biology, so no chemistry, no physics, and defined as any honors English class, period. So we talk about the STEM crisis and so forth in this country, and yet we can't even offer physics or chemistry or engineering or and so forth. Huge areas of non-consumption where you know that there are students and districts that want to offer those services for a variety of reasons having to do with scheduling, qualified teachers, and whatnot, could not. And therefore, online learning is a big relief to be able to introduce it there to start the disruptive innovation on its path.
Foreign languages might be another one.
Foreign languages are huge, and that's where you can actually start imagining how you stretch into elementary school as well, because it turns out it's easier to learn a foreign language when you're younger, and yet there's not many elementary schools that either offer that or do a good job of offering that. So there's some pretty exciting ways you can get that launched.
All right, let me ask you about some more of your business school jargon here. I love the words here. Quote, you write about, quote, disrupting the value network, end quote, which seems to be mostly about the way instructional materials are developed and implemented. What do you mean?
So in any system, basically, you have a value network where you have a series of players that work together, basically, to deliver the product. So I'll give you an example. One of the disruptions we talk a lot about in the book is the disruption of vacuum tube consumer electronics products by transistors. Probably a lot of people listening don't remember the vacuum tube, but they were about the size of your fist. They blew out every once in a while, but they enabled unbelievable technological marvels of the 50s and 60s to exist in the form of radios and televisions. And they were over time disrupted by these transistor powered products that couldn't handle maybe the power that those big machines could, but they enabled very affordable, simple TVs and radios to over time supplant them. And so Sony led the transistor disruption, and RCA was the company disrupted that had been offering vacuum tubes. But what was interesting was RCA existed in a value network, if you will, of other players. It wasn't just RCA, but they had component manufacturers that supplied the vacuum tubes and offered various parts of the technology to form the radios and televisions. And then they sold it through appliance stores that made their money not just by selling these technologies and these electronics, but actually by repairing the blown out vacuum tubes when they would go out every few months. And so when Sony came along with its transistor radio, this was a technology that never blew out. So you couldn't sell it through the appliance stores because they couldn't make money off the thing. And the component suppliers were totally different for the transistor than were the vacuum tube, and made their money in very different ways and were far less expensive. And so a whole value network actually had to come along to disrupt the system. It wasn't just that Sony could rise up. Instead, they actually had to get new component suppliers, and they had to sell it through discount retail stores like Target, Kmart, Walmart, that had no ability to service machines. And that was great because the machines didn't need any servicing. And so it was these mutually reinforced value network that came along to disrupt another value network. And our hypothesis was, you probably need something similar to come along in education, that the textbook producers, the textbook companies really own the market right now. And they sit in this value chain of textbook adoption processes, authors that write for them, editors that edit them, teachers that accept them.
Distribution channels.
Distribution channels, huge sales forces, right, to work with 15,000 districts. And all of these were mutually reinforcing. And to disrupt that, you probably needed a new mechanism to really break through. And I think Khan Academy actually is sort of showing the wisdom of that prediction now in retrospect, which is interesting.
Say more about that.
Yeah, so in that chapter where we talked about the value network, we hypothesized that what would be the true disruption, so you'd have these online learning courses come along that would still be produced in the monolithic way that a lot of our courses had, a lot of our textbooks had been produced. A couple authors creating a linear sequence of learning materials, and then districts would buy the entire sequence, if you will, of instructional materials. But the big disruption would come when it would shift to a facilitated network, is what we called it in the book. Basically, all that meant was user-generated content on a network that would allow you to pull down different pieces based on your needs. And Khan Academy, I think, started by Sal Khan, the former hedge fund trader, really is typifying that story, I think, that we predicted, which is he started out by just offering these little YouTube videos over the internet to help his nephews in New Orleans learn math concepts. And then people started using it like wildfire across the internet, and it grew to several million people using the Khan Academy lessons and assessments and so forth. And if you talk to Sal Khan 2 years ago, he would have said, well, there's going to be like four master lecturers in the world and everyone will get their learning material from them. If you look at now what they're doing, they're opening up the platform to allow teachers and professors and parents and students anywhere to create their own little modules of learning for various different concepts, relate from math to science to the French Revolution in history. And they're starting to create adaptive platforms underneath based on the assessment to start to mix and match the right learning sequences for different students. It's really early, but it's fascinating to watch how that's evolving. And the way it's getting adopted is not through these textbook adoption committees, but instead they're just handling little tutoring problems at first. And gradually now they're starting to be introduced as full course sequences, actually, in some limited schools. And teachers are just pulling them in to quote unquote flip their classroom, where the learning and the lesson gets delivered at home and the work gets delivered in the classroom. So it's really interesting to see this bear out.
This chapter you had on student motivation, I thought was very compelling. You talk about the job that students are trying to do. What do you mean?
So what we've seen in our study of marketing from the business school of research is that the way we teach marketing is fundamentally flawed. We always think about the world in terms of customer demographic or product category, and then we sort of do this bunching and averaging of people who are, you know, 35 to 49 with or without kids and so forth, and assume that they're on average will be likely to buy products. But the problem is that the world never looks this way from the user, him or herself. Instead, we just have jobs or problems that arise in our lives, and we hire different products or services to help us do those jobs. And actually, this was the missing chapter, I think, in the first edition of the book that we introduced in the second edition, which I think went a long way to helping the book be better. Because what we observed was that doing school really isn't a job that students are trying to do. And we sort of assume that, well, of course they want to do school and we're offering school. Why aren't they buying it? Why aren't they doing it? But instead, students just want to feel successful in their lives, like really all of us do. And they want to have fun with their friends in many cases. And those are the two fundamental jobs that we think students have as they're growing up as kids. And school is just one thing that they can hire to help themselves do that job. But if you look at it from a motivation perspective, you see that schooling doesn't actually do those jobs well at all. In fact, it makes most kids feel like failures, and it separates out the extracurriculars and all those things that where students have opportunities to feel success from those activities where from the traditional academic curriculum that where the opportunities to feel successful only occur every 3 to 4 weeks when there's a test, and then a lot of that is graded on a curve, so most students fail or don't do particularly well and have no way to make up those questions and get the learning that they need. And it's this just huge spiral of failure that's inculcated in the school system that makes it incredibly demotivating for students to want to come in there. And one of the things that we concluded from the chapter is it's not the case that students that there are motivated students and unmotivated students in the world. We think everyone is motivated to feel successful in life, but the way school is currently structured and the way it currently markets itself, if you will, to students, is only set up to work for a fraction of students. And that's why you see the dropout numbers we do and the numbers of abject failure, really, when kids get to college as well. We think has a lot to do with the fundamental structure itself. And this maps on really well, I think, by the way, to Willingham's cognitive science research in terms of how you motivate students and keeping the learning just above their activity, giving them frequent feedback, but not feedback for feedback's sake, feedback so that they can actually improve performance and do something about what they learned from the assessment.
Excellent. Well, it's all very exciting. So the question is, of course, where do we go from here? It seems like in the world of private industry, this almost happens on its own. I mean, you've got markets and venture capital and people out there trying to invent the next best mousetrap. Is that going to happen in education too, or do we actually need to change some policies and structures?
So yes and no is the answer. I think on the yes side is that the digital learning, broadly speaking, I think that's going to grow because for a variety of reasons. Budget cuts being a huge one, the affordability for school systems to actually buy these online instructional options as opposed to textbooks and so forth will be a huge reason, I think, that the growth curve that we project, 2019, 50% of all high school courses online, give or take a few years on either side of that, I think that'll come true. The big question, I think, is will it transform the system to be a student-centric one? And to me, that's totally a policy game. If you think about it from a jobs to be done perspective that we just talked, really policy sets the jobs to be done that districts and states are trying to do with their school systems. And right now our policies reward a compliance input-based mentality in the education system. So just because online learning is growing doesn't mean districts have an incentive to buy the best curriculum for their kids or to get several different options and choices for students so that they can find the right one that matches their needs. Instead, in many cases, they have the incentive to do a race to the bottom, if you will, and pick this, just the cheapest thing that gets the job done based on today's requirements. And I think this is all about a policy game where we really have to be very, I'm going to use your wording, we have to be very tight on the outcomes we expect, but very loose on the ways that the actors on the ground get there. And we have not done a good job at all of that historically. And by definition, being tight on the inputs restricts the ability to innovate. It actually means that you will replicate the current factory model system online. And I'm petrified about the fact that we'll come back in 7-8 years from now, have hit somewhere close to the 50% of all high school courses online number, and yet the system will function largely as it does today based on time being fixed and learning being highly variable for different students. While I think there will be some natural progression toward individualization because of the interest from the private sector community in this and the amount of venture capital money going into it right now, and people like Sal Khan who are intent on individualizing learning, I think we can screw it up in some pretty profound ways if we don't address those policy issues.
Okay, a call to arms from Michael Horn, the co-author of Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns, with Clayton Christensen and Curtis Johnson. Michael, thank you for joining us on this edition of the Education Next Book Club. Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterin. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.